Okay, this week, my lecture at least will be different than last week. Last week, all of us focused on kind of fundamentals underlying our disciplines. Given that we've already done that for about half of you, we're going to presume the other half of you are going to get this by osmosis. So I want to give a slightly broader view just to set the stage for us all to be thinking about these issues of mantle heterogeneity. I'm going to talk mostly about geochemistry, but I'll try to set it in the context of the other disciplines. Try to focus on what it is we need to do across disciplines to move ahead. The geochemists have been isolated we've all been isolated for many years. And each of us, at least I can speak for the geochemistry, we're stuck in various places because we're stuck in areas that we need help on from other disciplines. So I'll try to highlight those as we go along. This is my sort of overview of mantle heterogeneities. Don, do you have your laser pointer with you? Would you want to do that? You won't miss much. It's just that this stick is only so long. How do we know that the mantle's heterogeneous? How are these heterogeneities made? How big are they? How do they last? Physical consequences, and where do we go next once we've figured out these things? So some of the things I would highlight as needing, or places where we're stuck, or new things to think about that may allow us to move ahead. The isotope geochemists think about heterogeneities as being injected into the mantle from the plate circuit. In other words, you subduct a plate with sediment on it and let it sit around the mantle and you produce heterogeneity. This doesn't seem to actually work, or at least in some cases. So we need to consider possible production of heterogeneities in other places. And these are just blue sky, okay? Melt solid partitioning in the ultra-low velocity zone, reactions between the metal core and the silicate mantle, interphase.
If it stops working, just tap it a few times.
Okay. Fractionations possibly between phases as you convert phases going through the phase transitions. I think one of the biggest issues for a geochemist, at least the biggest issue for me, is what happens to heterogeneities if they exist on small scale, and by small scale I mean ones of kilometers. That's the scale where melting samples the mantle. And geochemists are stuck because we view mantle heterogeneity almost totally through the melts that are derived from the mantle. And the melting process is an averaging process, but it looks at sort of 10 kilometer scale boxes. So we need to know how heterogeneities on that scale are actually produced and how they survive. And just to give you a little, this is an old classic picture. And I'm sure there are many, many more pictures like this. I just like this one. This is just the mixing of you start with a box and mix it for many, many years. Just to show that, okay, these are heterogeneities that have been introduced initially, but they're beginning to be stirred and mixed in. Now this is 700 kilometers from here to here. The isotope geochemists really want to know what's happening in this little teeny box right here. Okay, the dynamicists work on a much larger scale, and there's a mismatch in scales. The dynamicists work down to order 100 kilometers. The isotope people would like to work at 10 kilometers, and one of my fond hopes would be that we figure out how to bridge that gap. Okay. All right, so let's do a little review views of the mantle. This is my cartoon, not as popular as Louise's. A little more detail in it. There are two views of the mantle here, and these two end member models for the mantle have been around for about 30 years, and we haven't actually changed the view much. The left side is layered mantle convection, lower mantle convecting separately from upper mantle, little or no mass transport across the transition zone, which then means plumes must derive from the upper mantle, maybe from this transition zone. This is the left view. The right view, and I emphasize the word right just because that's my own opinion, is some version of whole mantle convection where plumes come from the bottom, plates go all the way down. There's an intermediate view, which is a so-called mantle avalanche model, where things get hung up here so that you have an episodic injection of material from the upper mantle and then perhaps layered mantle convection, either spatially or temporally in time. Okay, so the isotope geochemists view the mantle almost totally. Okay, John, how hard can I hit it? All right, very good. We view the mantle almost totally through the volcanics that are erupted on the surface. We have very little control of anything. We know sort of crude depths of origin for these magmas, 100 kilometers, 150 kilometers. That's our limit of being able to say where they came from. But we have no way of saying where the box of mantle came from that actually did the melting, okay? And we never will. We're very good at categorizing on a very, very high precision the heterogeneities, but we're very poor at saying where they exist, or in fact, even where they come from. Okay, so this, my view of this is, of course, isotopic, so give you a very quick rundown on the isotopic zoo, or mantle taxonomy, as you might say. We talk a lot about isotopes, and you don't need to worry very much about what the numbers are or how we get them. But it's like doing DNA on the mantle, DNA analysis. Over the years, the isotope guys have split the mantle into at least four major boxes. One we call enriched mantle 2 because it has high strontium. Enriched mantle 1, which also has high strontium but also has high neodymium. High mu, which is high uranium lead, therefore high 6-4 lead. And then this upper mantle, we're pretty sure we know where this box is, its upper mantle, and it produces all the basalts that are erupted on ridges. Okay. So some other bulk earth comes up over and over again. The geochemists would love to have somebody grind up the earth and give us a little vial with a thing that was really bulk earth. We think, okay, that it would plot here on this diagram. We're pretty sure the 6-4 that it would plot at, little more unsure of the actual strontium, but it's in this region somewhere. And as I'll show you as we go along, currently there are no samples that we've ever found that actually have all the characteristics of bulk earth. It may seem like this pit cairn is pretty close, and it is in this space, but it's not close in helium space or osmium space, or, you know. So we've got lots of isotopes to work with. Just to get you a little oriented in another isotope space. This is two different lead isotope ratios, and again, it doesn't matter what the numbers mean. This particular diagram is really helpful because the one thing we know about the Earth is the location of this line here, which we call a geochron. So if you had bulk Earth, if it has to lie on this line somewhere. I put it in particular right here This plume is called primitive upper mantle. We think this is the same as bulk earth, but all we can say for sure is it's primitive. It's what the upper mantle used to look like when it was primitive. So there is an enriched field over here, which is enriched in uranium lead relative to the geochron. There's a depleted field over here. And you see that there's a sort of an array going off in this direction. The other nice thing about this diagram is there are ages involved in all of the arrays on this diagram. So the age of this geochron, for example, is 4.53 billion years. If you were to just put a line through here and look at the age, it would be of order 2 billion years. So what this tells us is that we have all of these, this mantle zoo, okay, which we can distinguish isotopically very well. But the other issue is these mantle boxes that the zoo comes from have to be kept separate for a long time. Okay, and that's really the challenge for us and for everybody, I think, is how do you make these heterogeneities, but then more difficult is how do you keep them from getting mixed up over, let's say, 2 billion years. Okay, you can figure out ways of making them, but it seems to me we're stuck on where they are, and how can you put all of these, there are now five species in the mantle zoo, and they have to be kept in cages for 2 billion years. And how do you do that? And that gets back to this mixing and stirring problem. So to expand, we've looked at two isotope plots in two dimensions, just to show you that this exists in three dimensions, and in fact it exists in five dimensions. Okay, this is, again, the same three isotopes, neodymium, strontium, 206, 204 lead, and we have these same end members, EM2 upper mantle, EM1 high mu, and this primitive mantle, okay, and basically in 3D isotope space, you can enclose all of the known samples that have been analyzed from the oceans in this tetrahedron. There are various island groups that I'll show you more of in a minute. So that's the zoo. This is just the same thing, showing you the individual samples and showing you different perspectives on this tetrahedron. So you get some feeling of how the samples fill this tetrahedron and how they would look when you look at it in different perspectives. Another view of this tetrahedron, largely to show you that these mantle heterogeneities are organized. They're not just random. If you go to an island, you don't find samples that fill this tetrahedron. You find samples that are form arrays, typically, or little blobs. Okay, so they're not just randomly distributed. They actually look like a species that probably is mixing to other species, crossbreeding, if you like. Okay. So this seems simple. It's pretty robust. The problem, we'll talk more about the helium in a minute. The problem is that the corners, the end members that define the corners of this tetrahedron, all have sort of modest helium 3-4 ratios. Typically, this upper mantle is about 8 times atmospheric. These corners, this is about 7, maybe 10, maybe 11, okay, of order. But we also find samples in various places that are very high in helium 3. For example, Lauihi in Hawaii, Galapagos, Iceland, all have helium values above 30. Iceland right now is the world record holder with a helium of about 43. If you look at all of this, where these particular high helium samples plot, they all plot in this region, inside the tetrahedron, but not on one of the corners. So we proposed years ago that there was another n-member, which isn't an n-member of the tetrahedron because it's internal, but it's nevertheless an n-member, which we call Fozo. So just so you'll know what the name Fozo, it's another species that has high helium. Okay, so the conventional wisdom about how you make these things and so forth is that you subduct ocean crust, you have a veneer of sediment on top of it, so this goes down into the deep mantle and you store it someplace for a few billion years so it can generate all these isotopic heterogeneities, and then you recycle it in plumes that sample this ancient batch of subducted material. And the isotope geochemists have specified which of the species comes from which part of this subducted slab. Namely, the high mu is ocean crust itself, altered ocean crust, and then these two end members are mantle that has a small component of either terrigenous or pelagic sediment. This, of course, is the upper mantle, which is basically depleted. This, I think, we understand reasonably well. In this standard model, there is no source, no obvious source for Fozo, okay? This material that's going down, we expect will have very low helium-3. It will not even remotely look like the high helium that we see in Iceland. Let me just say, without going into detail, we understand this. We've been working on these others to see how you can actually model them in terms of this standard model, okay? And the problem is, in this subduction zone, there's a lot of chemistry that goes on. This slab, these sediments get dewatered, devolatilized, partially melted, re-equilibrated, metamorphosed. There's so many things going on that it's almost a free parameter. If you want to do anything whatsoever here, you're pretty much allowed to do it. Okay. So while we know what the isotopic characteristics of old recycled material here is going to be like, we have a very poor idea of what it will be like after it goes into the deep mantle. But some recent work on Samoa, which is an end member EM2, it's the definition of EM2, trying to work through all of the isotope systems to see if we can model EM2 in terms of this standard model, fails in almost every direction. Okay, it does not have low helium. In fact, it's slightly high. It does not have high osmium, which you expect for material here. It does not have high oxygen, which it should have if it's been close to the surface. So, and it doesn't have any of the trace element anomalies that sediment carry with it, which are quite distinctive. So we, at this point, think this model doesn't work for EM2. We don't know yet about these guys. So you might ask, what do the trace elements look like in these end members? We know they're distinct isotopically. How distinct are they in chemistry? And this is just sort of an average. Okay, this is a spidogram, and the people that have been here the last few weeks are well acquainted with spidograms. For the newcomers, maybe we don't need to go into a lot of detail. These are a bunch of trace elements, and they're put on this diagram in the order in which they dislike to be in crystals relative to melt. So these guys are strongly partitioned into melt rather than crystals, and these guys less so. Okay. This is the upper mantle, MORB, and we would call this a depleted pattern, meaning the most incompatible elements are underrepresented. The averages for these three other species, EM1, EM2, high mu, to first order look alike. Indeed, there are, for a trace element geochemist, there are pretty major differences in this region, but the first order, they look alike. So the hypothesis would be, well, the mantle chemistry that these are all derived from is not drastically variable between these different end members. I emphasized last week that to make these isotopic heterogeneities requires relatively minor variations in parent-daughter ratio. Okay. For example, one of the systems we look at is neodymium isotopes, and the radiogenic daughter is produced from samarium. So we're interested in the slope between neodymium and samarium. Okay. To produce the whole range of neodymium isotopes between all of the species in the zoo in 2 billion years requires only a 25% variation in that slope. So in this diagram, you would barely notice that. And that's generally true for the others. They take larger variations in general, but it's not as if you're going from extremely different compositions. So to explain the EM2 species that we no longer think is recycled sediment, we've gone to a slightly different part of the subducting slab. So instead of taking EM2 off the top, we're proposing to take it off the bottom. And that's produced by partial melt that doesn't get separated on the ridge crest during the upwelling, but is perhaps carried in the upper mantle, the low velocity zone, the asthenosphere, whatever you want to call it, and re-interacts with the overlying lithosphere, basically enriching it in a metasomatic process. And then you can, in fact, you can model all of the trace elements and isotopes in this particular species with this kind of a model, okay? So how's that different? Well, it's not really very different, except being on the bottom of the lithosphere means this chemical factory here that disturbs everything else probably does not act on the bottom of the lithosphere. So we're better off in being able to model it without this very complicated black box. The other issue is the scale length. The stuff you inject from the top of the lithosphere is a few hundred meters of sediment, 6 kilometers of ocean crust. Okay, so you're injecting scale lengths that are less than 10 kilometers. This scale length could be of order 100. So the scale length is possibly larger. So what about the helium problem? The fact that none of these end members has high helium. And helium has always, forever, been the major tracer for deep mantle. You know, it's just fixed in people's minds now that when you find something that's high helium, it had to come from the deep mantle. The thinking behind that concept is that when you erupt anything near the surface, helium will be more incompatible than uranium. Okay, so you basically strip the helium during the melting and then during the extrusion of these. Clearly, the helium wants to go away. The parent, which is uranium and thorium, stays in either the melt or in the crystallized products of the melt. So this area is viewed as one where you make material of high uranium helium, which will then generate low 3-4 ratios. And again, the people from last week understand the confusion engendered by the helium isotope guys, where they have for years talked about helium as 3/4. Well, that's the reference isotope divided by the daughter, which is crazy because all of the other isotope systems we talk about upside down. So talking about helium 3-4 is like talking about strontium 86-87. Okay. So you have to keep switching back and forth in your mind. So we have no other tracers for primitive mantle Well, we have lots of traces. We have no evidence for primitive mantle, but the best evidence for deep, primordial, undegassed, unperturbed material has been helium. I just want to quickly show you that that depends on an assumption about how uranium and helium behave, and perhaps that our whole thinking is wrong. And we don't know the answer to this yet, but it's just to loosen up the thinking about helium. This is helium-4-3 now, which is daughter over the reference. And this is age. This just shows how systems evolve in helium over time. If we have primordial, whatever the Earth was accreted with in terms of helium, it's probably more like 300 Ra instead of 100. But if you have then a closed system, it will evolve along a curved line like this and end up today here. Now the standard model would have bulk Earth being being lower, in other words, higher in helium 3-4. Remember, this 3-4 ratio is what we all talk about, and it increases going down. So the concept, the standard model all along is when you have high helium 3-4, it means unperturbed primordial reservoir. And in this model, the bulk Earth would be the lowest evolution line on this plot. But that's based on the concept that helium is incompatible relative to uranium. There's no really good evidence for that, except people's, they think, oh, helium's a gas. Well, clearly it's going to be incompatible. But it's not a gas in these systems. So we simply propose that, in fact, helium might be compatible relative to uranium. And some measurements, experimental work, has shown that it's not different from uranium by more than a factor of 2, one way or the other, and we don't know the answer yet. But if you allow that to work, if you allow it to work that way, then bulk Earth might indeed be some evolution line like this. But a processed reservoir, in this thinking, would have lost uranium relative to helium. So it would grow less helium-4 with time and could actually follow a path with higher helium-3-4 ratios. Okay, for example, Lauihi, which is one of the high helium islands or submarine seamounts, could grow here to a ratio of about 35 today. Iceland is somewhere around 40. There is one helium measurement on old Kamadiites, which is quite high in 3-4. So you could develop a whole bunch of systems that are not primordial at all, but that have high helium 3-4. So I think it means we need to free up our concept a little bit about what helium is telling us. This would remove many of the incompatibilities between helium and all the other isotope systems. Okay. There are none of the high helium, and Don made this point last week, none of the high helium 3 islands, okay, by the old thinking where these are primordial, none of them have strontium, neodymium, or lead that is primordial. And the lead, as I said, was most easily specified as being primordial. It has to be in the geochron. None of the high helium 3-4 islands have geochron lead. It's just a simple fact. And this has been a puzzle for years, and this may fix the puzzle. So let me quickly, sort of now that we have an overall grasp of the isotope systems, switch to trying to understand what they tell us about scale length. Okay, and there's kind of minimal information on this, but since this is the topic of the workshop, I need to at least show you my view of what constraints isotopes actually place on scale lengths. So I start at the smallest scale length, and nobody saw this last week. Again, it's a lead-lead diagram. That's not important what the numbers mean. This is the tetrahedron Okay, EM2, DMM, the upper mantle, EM1, high mu. So it's a funny view of the tetrahedron in this particular isotope space. What all these points are melt inclusions. These are 100 micron melt inclusions trapped in olivine phenocrys sitting in basalts from a few samples. There's one sample from Pitcairn, a couple samples from Mangaia, which is the N-member high mu, and I'll show you some MORB data in a minute. And this is Taha in the societies is fairly extreme EM2. So what Alberto Sal did in 1998 is take an ion probe, measure the lead isotope ratios in these melt inclusions. Now this is the smallest conceivable scale. And I should tell you that Mangaia, if you sample the basalts all over the island, they're almost within error of the same lead isotope ratio. So if we were to plot all of the basalts of Mangaia, they would all plot within this little circle. You go and you look at these melt inclusions, and they fill this whole field. In other words, they show a variation that's about half of the total variation we see in all oceanic mantle. Okay, so that is a little scary to isotope geochemists to think that the heterogeneities in the mantle exist on large scale. We could talk a lot about what this means. I think it means the melt sampling system, whatever it is, whatever the nature of the plumbing system is, it has the ability to sample melts from very heterogeneous domains and present them at the surface in these olivine phenocrysts prior to them being mixed in a magma chamber. And Pitcairn, the same thing. If you go to the island, you actually find basalts that fill this region. But in one sample, you find the whole variation that you would find in dozens of samples. Now, we worked last week on MORB and the isotopic heterogeneity in MORB around the world and on small scale. And this is the same diagram, same tetrahedron. MORB has pretty constant lead isotope varies ratios around the world. And yet, when you look at one sample of MORB, look at the olivines with the melt inclusions, the lead varies in this whole region. Again, it fills almost half of isotope space. Okay. In samples that are otherwise pretty homogeneous around the world, in fact. Okay, so that's the smallest scale. This doesn't really help us, clearly, in tying the isotopic heterogeneities to anything else you can measure in the mantle. Now I want to go totally to the other end of the scale because I think there's some evidence from isotopes that these species in the zoo actually do correlate with large-scale geophysical structures. And the easiest way to present this is the so-called Dupal anomaly. And this is just strontium isotopes. I made it really simple. I'll show you some other projections in a minute. You plot, and this is an old figure, but I can tell you that it would not change if we put all the data from GeoRock in it. There would be some samples now off the graph at 14 South from Samoa. So there are a bunch of more extreme samples, but otherwise there's nothing up here that has changed. It's just plotting all of the hotspots, all of the islands, strontium isotopes and basalts as a function of latitude. And you can see there's a clear peak, so that the most radiogenic strontium values, and these would represent the EM1, EM2 species, all occur in the southern hemisphere. To show you that in another perspective, which is neodymium lead, strontium lead, and where we split the data set into, this is from a review paper by Rick Carlson, split the data into northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere, and you just plot all the samples in GeoRock, and there are the N members here, high mu, EM2, DMM, EM1, Northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere. And again, you see the southern hemisphere is more extreme in all directions. In other words, there are more extreme values of high mu, and DMM is the same in both hemispheres, EM1 and EM2. It's just to show you that for some reason, southern hemisphere hotspots are much more isotopically variable than northern hemisphere. We made an attempt to map this or contour this in the world a long time ago. And let's stick to strontium, since that's a little, it's a one-dimensional thing, okay? This is just plotting the strontium isotopes, the average for an island, for a hotspot, for all the hotspots in the world. And the highest values occupy these kind of peaks on what looks like a belt of high strontium isotope ratios, and that was called the DuPaul anomaly. If you look at a map of hotspots in the world, you realize there are several strange characteristics. First, there are very few hotspots in northern latitudes. Okay, Iceland is, wherever Iceland is the northernmost well-defined hotspot in the northern hemisphere. Beleni, which is somewhere here, somewhere there, is the southernmost. Yeah, Jake? Well, okay. People have mapped plumes on continents. So if you believe in the plume model, the plume catalog has plenty of plumes on continents. I could have put them on here, but a lot of those plumes get messed up with continental contamination, which looks like an EM1 or EM2 thing. And in my view, I've just stayed away from continents. I think if you take the total plume catalog, though, as defined by anybody, the same thing is true. There are very few plumes in northern latitudes or in high latitudes. Either continents are and statistically true. And it's always been a curiosity to me that I don't understand. Okay, so I just want to tie this DuPaul belt and these particular highs into some geophysical parameters, okay? And it doesn't mean one proves the other or vice versa. But it is a large-scale connection between isotopes and geophysical parameters. And as I said, the isotope guys are really stuck because they have no depth resolution whatsoever. And our only hope of really bridging this gap is to somehow connect the surface isotope mapping into three dimensions through tomography or whatever. This is a familiar plot. Indeed. Adam wants his figure to look better. If I do that, I'm probably going to okay.
Was that supposed to help?
Yeah, well, it did help, right? I'll show you another version of this that'll show up better. But this is a really old deep mantle seismic contour map. And the basic issues are there are slow velocities here, here, here. And, okay, these were later associated with the so-called superplumes, and maybe this will show up better. So what we just saw was a contour map at pretty deep mantle levels. These things are organized into large-scale through-going mantle features. This one is called the Pacific superplume, and this one the African superplume or Great African plume or whatever. It attracted me because these superplumes are in exactly the places that have the most extreme isotopes. And you can say, well, there are only two super plumes, and maybe that's just a coincidence. This shows the same thing as the transparency that you couldn't see. And it's not meant to supersede it, even though it's from the Princeton group. Okay, here's the super plume, African super plume. And basically, while the Princeton groups managed to separate these by virtue of their choice of contour levels, this whole bunch of smaller hotspots is the Pacific super plume. And they match with these extreme hotspots. Okay, Samoa is right here. I'm not sure what that one is. But so there's some correlation between.
And isn't it true that all those plumes are also plumes with low buoyancy flux?
Well, relative to what? Everything has low buoyancy flux except Hawaii. If you wipe Hawaii out. They're all of order, well, it depends. Last week we realized you had to rescale all plume fluxes by a factor of 3. So in the old classification where Hawaii is 8, most of these other guys are 2 or 3. Iceland's not very large in plume flux, surprisingly, in the old version. But okay. All right, so that's, I guess that's the best we can do, connecting isotopes to anything in the deep Earth. And it will either be convincing or not. I think it will be more convincing when the tomography gets better so we can track these things from the deep mantle to the surface. And the Princeton group, of course, claims they have done that, but we didn't hear a whole lot of support last week for that. In fact, no support. But I think things will, well, we'll either know this or we won't know this within the next few years. So we don't need to solve the problem. Just finally, for a few minutes, I want to turn around a little bit and ask the question of what, okay, we map isotopic variations in mantle back into composition of the mantle. And now we've done this pretty well for the upper mantle. In other words, we know the bulk major element composition of the upper mantle, we know the spidogram, and we know the isotopes. We've done the same thing for EM2. We have yet to satisfactorily do it for EM1 or high mu or FOSO. But the simple question, again, because we're trying to correlate this isotope zoo with geophysics of some kind. So we need to ask, what would the differences in chemistry that we can infer from the isotopes, what would those differences mean to a geophysicist? Okay. And unfortunately, it means the geophysicists have to really work harder. Okay. All I've done is take what we know about the major element composition in the spidograms for bulk silicate earth, depleted upper mantle, and this EM2 source with just a bunch of physical parameters, okay? Density, P wave, S wave velocity, heat generation, and then just to summarize it here, looking at the difference between depleted mantle and bulk silicate earth. Okay, in these parameters, and looking at the difference between this enriched mantle and bulk silicate earth. And you see density variations are a few tenths of a percent, up to maybe 0.5%. Velocity variations the same. The heat generation is grossly different. Okay, bulk earth is about 5 times what the depleted upper mantle is, and this enriched mantle is about 10 times the depleted upper mantle. So there's a large variation in heat production coupled to pretty insignificant variations in seismic parameters. So to the extent that we've done this right, It means to really tie isotopes in geochemistry to geophysics is going to require resolving these parameters at a pretty low level, which I don't think we're quite there yet. One question in terms of heterogeneity, we talked about isotopic heterogeneity and geochemical heterogeneity. We could ask the question, it's usually assumed that plumes have to come from a boundary layer and that mantle convection itself is driven by either cooling of the top boundary or heating of the bottom boundary and so forth. And for many years, people have assumed internal heating, while it will drive convection, is not sufficient to drive small-scale convection. So just to put these numbers in context, okay, the difference between the most enriched material and the least enriched material, if you were to put it in a box in the mantle and have a layer of this embedded in a large semi-infinite domain of that, would it generate a temperature anomaly? Okay, and that's again a connection between the geochemistry and the dynamics of the mantle, and it's just a simple calculation, but and I guess the bottom one has all the information in it. Look at time in billions of years from the time you start to heat this material, and this now is the most enriched material embedded in the least enriched material. Temperature anomaly in the center of a layer of thickness 10, 50, 100 kilometers. And basically my take-home message from this is, well, we might think of heterogeneities that we've injected that are of order 50 kilometers, maybe 100 kilometers. And certainly the timescales for these heterogeneities based on isotopes are of order 1 billion to 2 billion years. So we're in the range of perhaps 40 to maybe 80 degrees of heating, special heating, inside these geochemical heterogeneities. Now, I don't think something down here is going to perturb the dynamics. I think something up here might make a difference, but hopefully this week the dynamicists will tell us whether that's really true. Okay, so to close, and again, because of the interdisciplinary nature of this workshop, I think we should all address the issue of where do we need help and where do we think we help might arrive. The most obvious one for the geochemists is to know where these things come from. I've used the word plumes. I could be more careful and say, do hotspots derive from the CMB? Because there are some members of the audience that probably don't believe in plumes. Looking at Don, he's not smiling. Okay. Then for the dynamicists, we go right back to the first mixing and stirring diagram. If you inject 7 kilometer heterogeneities or 100 kilometer heterogeneities, can you make them survive for 2 billion years? And how do you do that? It's not clear to me, based on the upper scale length that has been modeled successfully so far, it's not clear to me that you can successfully do that. So there may be a major problem for the geochemists there. For this model of metasomatism of the oceanic lithosphere, which is the model for where EM2, that species, comes from, question is, we need for that metasomatism to operate, we need a little bit of melt under at least some part of the oceanic plate, the lithosphere. And so to what extent is it allowed? Are we allowed to put melt there? And then for the geochemistry, partly to understand the total Earth budget with respect to stuff that might be in the core that is unaccounted for. And we, the geochemists, are missing a lot of things. We're missing a lot of lead, for example, because of this paradox that everything we look at lies to the right of the geochron. Other light elements in the core, particularly the radioactive elements, because that drives the dynamics, but also things that we have puzzles about, which is, for example, helium. Could you put a massive reservoir of helium-3 in the core, which we can then use as we need to put into our hotspots? Okay, thank you. Thorne?
I'm still trying to get my mind around the observation that the small melt inclusions having such heterogeneity.
Yeah.
I would quit at that point. You know, it's like you kind of trade it down to the finest scale, and you find one rock sample having half of your global heterogeneity. Doesn't that tell you that the process producing those heterogeneities can occur on a very small scale? Do you really believe that? Little droplets of milk from all the different reservoirs that it mixed in with one rock sample?
I almost did. But I've invested too much effort in it.
Why don't you?
Okay, because everything else, the model that we carried into that seemed to behave so well that it was really hard to give it up, and it still is. So before giving up, I'd like to spend a little more time to see if I could actually understand that small-scale issue. I mean, my way out of it, okay, just in my head and not for public consumption, is I've always thought melting operated as a fractal tree. So it's sort of scale invariant, and you can sample large regions, domains that are separate from each other, and yet have the mix finally very, very close to the end. I mean, that's the way a fractal tree works. The last two branches to come together could be very different. Okay, that's pretty obvious. But then you have to go through some magic process to have those two rivers that come together be sampled in some small magma chamber, sort of in a heterogeneous way. That's the best I can do. And I know that's not very good. Well, it's really, I mean, unfortunately, it's really, really hard analytical measurement. So that hasn't been redone. And we need to do a whole lot more of that to try to actually understand on a very local scale. I mean, what you'd like to do is a bunch of phenocrysts from one sample and do it for five samples from the same flow, from the same volcano, from the same group of volcanoes, you know, in an expanding net, to see if you could understand that. And we, you know, it's still on the ragged edge of what's possible. Louise?
I have a clarifying question about that. Was the scale on the fine scale warp diagram the same as the scale on the global thing? In other words, does the,
yes,
the warp,
yes, yes,
the entire range of all OIV?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, both the MORB and the OIB slides that I showed have the same tetrahedron, and they still all fall within the tetrahedron.
Right.
Okay, so it doesn't expand the tetrahedron. I don't know whether you remember the size of that, if I could find it quickly. I mean, that's the OIB part. Probably the part I need, I can't find. But anyway, in terms of the MORB, the same slide that had the sample of MORB in it, it occupied a field like this, still inside the tetrahedron. The errors are large.
All the way down behind.
No. It was in this region. Mm-hmm. We're still not 100% convinced that that data. The MORB is much harder to do than the OIBs because the lead concentrations are even lower. So it's still conceivable to me that some of the MORB data is simply analytical artifact.
And that's been done in just basically one location?
Yeah, one ion probe, one lab. I'm pretty confident about this data because there are also, in some of these melt inclusions, there are sulfides. So the lead was higher than normal, and the statistics look very good. So, but it's...
There's other evidence that there's small scale energy in the tour, if you just do...
Since the linear structure of this plot is something that is to be expected, or is it sort of spread?
Yeah, basically, it stems from the fact that it's hard to move the three lead isotopes very far away from each other, just because two of them are coupled through the two uranium parents. One's coupled through uranium-thorium ratio, which is almost constant in nature. So the variation in this direction is basically all related to fractionations between uranium and lead. But you can't fractionate the two uranium isotopes, and you can't fractionate thorium-uranium very much. So the parent for this and the parent for that are basically linked. This projection, if you were to look in 3D lead space, you could open up the tetrahedron a little bit. But it's really hard to distinguish going across this way. Bon?
I'll just make a comment about three other things you...
Three?
Five or six.
Okay.
As far as Thorne's comment, giving up, I think what needs to be given up is the venerable reservoir concept. The idea that you can look at a seismic profile and say, okay, the lower mantle is this reservoir, and the upper mantle is this reservoir, and the lithosphere is that reservoir. I think you're slowly getting around the point of view that the mantle is composed of components, and that these components exist in all places, on all scales. The mantle is chemically and physically heterogeneous in everything, on just about every scale you can think of. Now, when you put slabs into the mantle, you got a whole bunch of scales, and you got a whole bunch of compositions, and the slabs equilibrate at a whole bunch of different depths. When you subduct a very young piece of oceanic lithosphere, it's going to warm up very quickly. And that brings up the second point. It's not just the radioactive heating. It's inserting a cold slab in a normal temperature mantle. If normal mantle, whatever that is close to the melting point, if you put a cold slab into it, it's going to warm up, it's going to equilibrate by conduction. The radioactive bit is very small. The melting point of parts of that slab are 100 or 200 degrees colder than normal mantle. So you're going to be melting for the salt part eventually. And the thin young slabs are going to equilibrate in the shallow mantle. So you have heterogeneities in melting points, you've got things other than radioactive heating to warm a slab up when you put it in the mantle. And I think that combined with the recycling and the component concept will help you get out of a lot of the binds that I think you're in. Third thing.
Okay,
you keep talking about high helium three and Iceland, Hawaii, and a lot of those are classic high helium three areas. They also have enormous scattering, enormous variance. So a lot of things you're showing, including this one under your DuPont anomalous truncheon latitude bit, it's the variance that's as impressive as the fact that you do have some high values. And I think Slava might talk about this tomorrow, but the central limit theorem is a very powerful theorem for understanding how some places can have an extreme value, other places have more or less the same value. It's just a matter of sampling at the end of your fractal tree. The magma chamber blending of this very heterogeneous mantle. And I think it's the wrong direction to go to try to get a convection calculation to get your stirring and stretching and homogenization. The mantle can be almost as inhomogeneous as you please, and the final melting process takes care of it.
Well, I still think we need to understand stirring and stretching on small scales, because you're going to put components in on arbitrarily small volumes. And truly, I think we need to understand how you make them like that and how you keep them like that. The 2 billion year age is really, really hard to get around. I mean, you can argue about whether it's 1 or 3 or something, but it's not 100 million. The time that you have to keep these components or reservoirs, whatever. Okay, so that's still an issue. And if you're going to float these things around.
I don't know if I'm going to have time to give a mini talk, but I think the problem can be solved, and it's one of these new ideas that a workshop should
start working.
Yeah, no, I...
And just in a nutshell, you can get a 2 billion-year timescale just thinking in terms of a mantle as being heterogeneous, and you're sweeping ridges around, you're sweeping trenches around, rather than just heterogeneous convection, taking stuff from a fixed trench to a fixed...
No, I understand that, but you still need a way to keep material isolated and closed system for 2 billion years.
I was going to finish my sentence, but maybe a mini talk would be better.
Okay, rather than this being your mini talk.
A lot of opportunities to give mini talks, and that's common to all the participants, especially in the afternoons, and after the first 3 days, I guess also in the morning, we kind of have spontaneous presentations.
Yeah. Any other comments or questions or?
Clarification, because I was trying to invert 3-4 ratios and 4-3 ratios.
That was our intent. You see, we tried.
Was your mechanism for sustaining a high 3-4 ratio was to have some process that selectively took away uranium?
Yep. I mean, for example.
Is that a melting process?
Mm-hmm. No, as I said, there's almost no experiments. We've been trying to do them. They're really messy. But to first order, the partitioning of uranium and helium between, for example, olivine and melt is the same. And what that means is within factor of 2 on both sides. But that factor of 2 is huge. And if you take melt out at a ridge and make a depleted Harzburgite residue, which is the lithosphere. If helium is compatible, that residue will actually have a low uranium-helium ratio. So it will retain its helium-3 signature better than if you had done the reverse. So that's the concept. And there's no fundamental reason why helium should be more incompatible based on anything we really know, and the measurements haven't been done. So, again, it's just trying to free our mind from the fixation on helium, high helium-3 as being the only indicator of deep mantle.
Some perspective on this, right now people are modeling melting with water, the friction coefficient with water of 0.01, so that the solid only
More. Okay. So this is our first coffee break of the second.